Week 10 is the outline we're starting in. It's March 20th, week 10. So we'll get into week 11 in a second. Okay, so the modern era, you could think of the modern era from the Renaissance to the Enlightenment, or all of that combined. Just think of it as the modern era. So when you're talking about modernism and the modern era, we just need to recognize that there was a desire to control and conquer. This was the age of the machine, the scientific revolution, the advance in technology. This is the age of analysis, where people were able to start fine-tuning their ways of looking at the world to get more sharper in their understanding of the world in terms of philosophy and science. So you have in modernism the quest for certainty and totalizing knowledge. So you have this quest to advance the project of understanding the entire universe. That was a modernist imperative. That was a modernist agenda, to advance all of human understanding, to get total understanding of everything. And there was also an emphasis on the individual that came out during that time. And you may start to reflect and say, oh, I remember hearing things about this and foundationalism and certainty from previous classes. So that all was a modernist notion and agenda. So given that quick backdrop, you can start to compare a little bit modernism and postmodernism. And Tony Jones, he used to be a Christian youth pastor. He wrote a recent book about the emerging church. Have you heard of the words emerging church in the last decade? Yeah, so the emerging church movement is a movement that is a postmodern Christian movement. It's a movement within Christianity to create postmodern churches, postmodern theology, postmodern ways of doing ministry. So the emerging church movement came about in the last 10, 15 years. Doug Padgett in Minnesota, Tony Jones, Brian McLaren, you may have heard his name, on the East Coast. These guys are kind of big-name pastors who do church a little different. Some have said, but I don't think it's true of him, Aaron McManus over at Mosaic in L.A., it's kind of emerging church-ish. I don't think that's the case, but I don't know his ministry too well. Regardless, some of these movements are more explicit in their postmodern overtones, and they don't shy away from saying that we're a postmodern sort of movement. And there, in the recent years, have been postmodern Christians that are in their 20-somethings, and these 20-something Christians that are very much postmodernist and do emerge and speak like the emerging church people speak. So it's kind of intriguing to talk to them, but it's also very frustrating. Because it's like, aren't you a Christian? You know, like, how can you think like that? So it... I think emerging church theology is different than liberalism in the sense that liberalism tends to take big strides towards rejecting conservative Christian understandings, whereas postmodernism just really... questions so much and wants to do things differently. So like liberalism would manifest in the social gospel. You may have heard that phrase, whereas postmodernism would manifest in social justice concerns. Similar, but different motives, I think, and different manifestations. But yeah, there definitely is a similarity. It's a good point. Well, these are our brothers and sisters, so I wouldn't call them evil, but they both have challenges. Well, yeah, something could be asked about the Catholics, right? So, you know, I don't want to answer those questions for you guys. You can answer them yourselves. But thanks for being provocative and controversial. If you're a Catholic in here, I'm sorry. No, there are some really awesome postmodern Christians, liberal Christians, and Catholics that are Christian. Somehow, some way, they find the truth about Jesus and live it. So we should applaud them. Now, modernism versus postmodernism. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like, in order to say that somebody is wrong, the postmodernist would say, well, you're operating from a modernist framework. And so how you can't criticize me as wrong because your culture, modernism, is telling you there's a bunch of right and wrongs. But in reality, there is no right and wrongs, or there are no views that are good or bad. So you're right. There's a bit of pushback from the postmodernist that says, you can't even criticize me because your worldview is one worldview among many. So we're going to get into that in a moment, but that's a good point. So modernism versus postmodernism. So if you, on the left side, you have a bunch of modernist notions. On the right side, a bunch of postmodern notions. So rational versus experiential, scientific versus spiritual, unanimity versus pluralistic, exclusive versus relative, egocentric versus altruistic, individualistic versus communal, functional versus creative. The emerging church movement, by the way, tends to stress highly the importance of community and creativity in the arts and different forms of expressions, social justice issues, like I mentioned, lots of candles in their churches, you know, lots of paintings, different things like that. That's all fine and good. These aren't things we're going to criticize tonight. I'm just giving you a sense of what this looks like from a postmodern perspective. Industrial versus environmental, local versus global. So postmoderns tend to have a very globalistic mindset about that other country over there is just as valuable and wonderful and good as America. So America doesn't have a, you know, a priori standing in the world of greatness. We just are one amongst many. There's nothing special about us. Another thing is compartmentalized versus holistic. So the postmodern tends to think of like holistic health, for instance, eating right and going on bike rides and things like that versus just going to the doctor and getting medicine. Getting the medicine, the pharmacy, that's more of a modernist notion. Doing holistic sort of health stuff is more of a postmodern notion. I'm just trying to give you a little sense of how to differentiate it in your mind. And relevant versus authentic. So the postmodern tends to emphasize being a very genuine, being yourself, being very authentic, and not this hiding behind some, you know, big desk or in the big office. You know, full disclosure is what they want from everybody. Okay, so Scott Smith's comparison of postmodernism and modernism. Similar sort of thing where you're kind of comparing the two to kind of understand it. Modernism emphasizes confidence in human reason apart from divine revelation, where one could know universal truths in all subject matters. Again, this quest for certainty, quest to know everything. Okay, so you have a confidence in human reason apart from divine revelation. With or without God, who cares? This is what man can do. We can go do these things and we can understand everything. Whereas in modernism, you have this fallibility of human reason, as well as its biases, and how it is all too often used to oppress people. So the postmodern recognizes that mankind has used their reason to arrive at conclusions that oppress people, and we ought not to be doing that in today's world. The youth of America are very upset that the homosexual community, the LGBT community, has been mistreated in the years past. It is shocking to them when teenagers, Christian or not, mistreat the LGBT community. They equate that to Hitler's genocide, you know, things like this. So you start to see this, especially in the millennials who were born after 1990. On the modernist side, you have the inevitability of progress and flourishing for the human. So eventually, this humanist idea, eventually we are going to become what evolution has directed us to become. Eventually we will be like gods ourselves. We'll have all of this power. We will be able to control things in ways that we never even could have dreamed of. And we say that only God can control things. So humanism is a big part of the modernist framework. Whereas postmodernism talks about the decay and destruction that occurs when humans are in power and hold the keys to knowledge. So once you let all these humans in power, they hold the keys to knowledge. And at the end of the day, bad stuff is going to happen. So there's a distrust in general of the abilities of humanity. Now, on the modernist side, you have objective truths that can apply to all people in every culture. So these transcultural truths that are the same and are applicable to all people across all national boundary lines, where you have, in the postmodernist framework, a pluralism with no imperialistic oppressive values that can impose or disrupt another. So they emphasize pluralism, and there are no transcultural objective morals that are applicable in all cultures. Each culture has the right to create their own moral standards and discover for themselves their own truth and create their own laws. And no other culture should impose their values on that culture. So the Christian missionary movement is frowned upon by the postmodern, because that is taking a worldview and bringing it to a vulnerable people group that doesn't know any better, and it's an imperialistic, colonialistic notion. So when you talk about the evils of the British Empire, of being imperialistic in Africa, India, these sorts of places, this is a very bad thing to the postmodern. Postmoderns criticize governments that are imperialistic and colonialistic. So when you talk about, when you hear a postmodern talk, they're going to use the word imperialistic and colonialistic, or colonialism. These are very depressing, terrible things to the postmodern. Now, we could skip this part here and go to philosophically. So philosophically, everything gets more complicated. So a lot of postmodernism is easy to work with and talk about in a class like this, because it is very cultural, and we encounter it all the time. Now, philosophically, though, it gets extremely complicated, because these three French guys, they're at the bottom of your page, are extremely complicated. And philosophy, if you haven't noticed, is about making simple things complicated. And when we're talking about understanding reality and understanding truth and how do we know what's real, epistemology, metaphysics, all these big words, and people writing huge books about stuff, I mean, it's just mind-boggling how ridiculous it gets. Now, so if you read these guys, I spent a lot of time last summer reading these guys, and it was a challenge. And in the existentialism stuff, when we talked about that, I spent a lot of time reading the existential thinkers, the source documents. And some of these guys are writing in German, and then it's translated to English, and these guys are writing in French, and it's translated in English, and it gets even more complicated. So I don't recommend just diving into some of these primary source documents by these guys or the other existential thinkers without giving yourself a book like the Truth Decays book to kind of read through first. Is that being passed around? Cool. So anyway, what I did is I took all of the philosophy of these three guys and I took it out of your outline. So I think you'll be happy to hear that you don't have to hear about this stuff from them. So I'm going to just interpret for you, I did last week interpret for you a lot of what they produce, and this week we'll criticize it. Now, the criticisms of cultural postmodernism will be different than the criticisms of philosophical postmodernism. So the criticisms of the cultural postmodernist movement are different than the criticisms for the philosophical postmodern movement, which are these guys. So Jurgen, if you want to criticize these guys, who basically were the thinkers that created the cultural movement, then you need to read a guy named Jurgen Habermas. And there's a quote I have for you in the next outline from him, so you can read that book. It'll be referenced. So if you really want to get into it, you could read that, and he'll really dive into the depths of why the postmodernist movement fails philosophically, and he's not a Christian, but he's a big-time philosopher. So a lot of the criticisms of postmodernism aren't just coming from conservative evangelicals. They're coming from other philosophers who think it's a lot of rubbish. So, without going into Michel Foucault, Derrida, and Lyotard, we're going to go down to your next outline there. So, we'll start week 11. And so we're asking the criticisms of postmodernism, okay? So the first criticism we can offer against postmodernism is this: that postmoderns misinterpret and do not describe modernism accurately. Okay, it's not a big criticism, but it's a criticism. So oftentimes when you read the postmoderns' writings, they tend to embellish things or describe things differently than is what's real. So they say that some of the views, some of the views that they say modernism brought about have been around for centuries. Okay, so they say that modernism brought about this quest for certainty and brought about this idea of getting a knowledge system that is complete and authoritative. They say that modernism brought that about. Well, it's not necessarily true. Other philosophies prior to modernism already had those notions there. Some of the views that they say modernism brought about do not have the severely damaging implications of our society that they describe. So the postmodern tends to beat up on modernism unnecessarily. They think that modernism has done us a terrible wrong, and it's led to all the thinking that led to the world wars. And so they really discount modernism and try to beat up on it. And it's not necessarily the best way to do things. Some of the views that they say modernism brought about were very postmodern in nature and laid the seeds for future postmodern views. So out of modernism, you have guys like Descartes and Hume and Kant, who were very modernist thinkers. However, some of their ideas were seeds that were planted in philosophy and in culture that eventually grew in the postmodern world. So when you talk about Kant's noumenal versus phenomenological realms, you are talking about the seeds of postmodernism. Now, Kant was definitely not postmodern in his motives, but he was postmodern in his content, so to speak, in a certain respect. So you can see the seeds of postmodernism there. Now, the reason why this is important is because when you're starting to bash a view, you want to know how that view led to your view before you start bashing it, because you may start bashing the root of your own view. So we see that the postmodernist is already critiquing modernism unnecessarily, and in doing so, he's bashing a view that his view comes out of. So postmoderns misinterpret overall and do not describe modernism accurately, and this leads to some challenges. The next criticism is this: that postmoderns reject the modernist tools that they need to use to reject modernist ideas. So similar kind of thing here. So they want to deny scientism and reductionism as bad modernist notions. They want to discard those and say these are really bad things. People that try to reduce the mind to brain states. And that's a bad idea. We don't want to keep reducing things just to material reality. So they beat up on scientism and this advance of technology the Western world has hailed and worshipped. And so we, as Christians, we say, yeah, those are bad things. Scientism, reductionism, yeah, beat up on those, you know. Those are really bad. So, however, in order to reject these modernist ideas, they must use the tools that modernism has given them. such as the laws of logic, certain realist features of reality, and certain basic argumentative principles. So the postmodernist rejects these modernist tools while it's critiquing modernism. So it's kind of starting to saw off the branch that they're standing on. In order to critique something, you can't use that something to critique it. So the only other way to use to critique modernism without using modernist tools is to use power to override that. So the postmodernist talks a lot about power, especially Michel Foucault, and he talks about how knowledge is power. With Francis Bacon, actually 400 years before that, again a modernist type thinker that we talked about here, he said knowledge is power at the time. Well, Foucault kind of brought that to light and showed how civilizations, as they changed over time, they changed because of who came to power, who rose to power in that culture. Those conquerors, those dictators who took over in military coups, so to speak, those dictators rewrote the history and the future of that culture. Some people have said that history is written by the victors. You may have heard that before. Well, Foucault, you know, really elaborated on this idea that all that we know today in this culture is because of the conquerors of the previous culture that are now our leaders, who set up the political system that we live in. If those guys didn't conquer the previous civilization, we would be in a different knowledge system today. Not just a political system, but a knowledge system. We would think very differently about the world. So Foucault really brought home this idea that those who write history are the victors of a culture. They champion it so they could make up the knowledge framework as they want to. So the only other way for postmoderns to critique modernism is to cause a cultural revolution and have people overthrow the current government and the current cultural system, and then create a new knowledge structure and web of coherence, like we talked about last week in the here and now. So, but they don't want to do that because they criticize people who come to power and take over and change the knowledge structure. So again, you see that postmoderns who are criticizing and critiquing the previous thought that was governing the time, modernism, they are using modernist ideas, or they use their own ideas that they say are bad. The idea that taking cultures over and changing the knowledge structure is bad. So they are again sawing off the branch that they're standing on. All right, so already we are seeing that postmodernism is a confused notion, and postmodernism speaks out against modernist notions without any substance to their criticism. So back to your outline here, if postmodernism uses substantial modernist tools of philosophy, it then is standing on the branch it begins to cut off, and so they're misled here, and it leads to self-refuting. And so, again, Jürgen Habermas, who I just mentioned, big-time critic of postmodernism, he claims that Nietzsche, Heidegger, Derrida, and Foucault commit a performative contradiction in their critiques of modernism by employing concepts and methods that only modern reason can provide. So you get the idea here that if you start critiquing modernism, you can't use their tools and their concepts and their methods to critique it. Any questions on this? Okay. Yeah. 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 But how? Yeah. A Mason? Yeah. The cult Mason? Yeah, I think you're right on the chaos theory. It tends to lead to that, you know. One of my best friend, believe it or not, he went up to Humboldt State University. It's apparently the largest weed-growing county outside of South America. Anyway, Humboldt State University is a Cal State, and he came from a similar background I did and moved up there and became an extreme postmodernist based on the philosophers up there and whatnot. And anyway, he developed his thinking more and kind of became an anarchist. So, yeah, there is a bit of anarchy as a fruit of postmodernism. That's very insightful. Okay. Now, any other questions on these two first criticisms? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, they're criticizing, in their writings, they criticize power struggles for cultural change by whoever is more powerful wins the culture. So power creates knowledge in that sense. So this criticism is saying that because they criticize that, the only other option they have is to do the same thing, and they can't do that. If they do, then they're contradicting themselves. Yeah. Yes, we can. Is that what you're getting at? Yeah. Yeah, you start to think about cultural movements changing the cultural language, you know, revolutions, then changing the tones and the words we say, civil rights movement, so to speak. That is really power of the masses, then changing the culture. Yeah, and so now, then, once you start changing the language, the words, then you can start enacting laws, and the laws are meant to change culture. Okay, good stuff. The postmodern rejection of foundationalism is a bad idea. So this is just a technical word for critiquing postmodernism. So once you start rejecting foundationalism, it's just you're going down the wrong path. So first of all, foundationalism is not dead. It's not dead in higher academic philosophy, and it's not dead for the masses. So philosophers today do not think that we need to have absolute bomb-proof certainty as Descartes thought he needed. Again, Descartes trying to get a totalizing system of knowledge based on a foundation. So many, if not most, philosophers today are foundationalists because they don't think like Descartes did. They don't think that you have to do this systematic, skeptical rejection of everything until you get that foundation. They think that we can know things, foundationally speaking, without Descartes' skepticism. So we don't need to be anti-foundationalist. So this implies that there are other forms of foundationalism that are more appealing than Cartesian foundationalism. Cartesian foundationalism is just Descartes' foundationalism. And so when we talk about foundationalism, we're not talking about extreme foundationalism like Descartes. We're talking about more of a moderate foundationalism. So here we could say foundationalism is not attaining Cartesian certainty, 100% bomb-proof certainty. It's about understanding things with enough level of belief where we can say we know things. We talked about our certainty meter going up and down in this class and being over 51% to 100% certain. Then we can say we know things depending on what it is and the gravity of it, you know, things like that. So attaining certainty was a modernist project and goal. They wanted certainty for everything. But Descartes thought that the base foundation for all beliefs can be developed. It must consist of indubitable beliefs, and this is called Cartesian foundationalism. So we are, though, entitled to know things without 100% certainty. We are justified, philosophically speaking, in knowing things even though we're not 100% certain. So knowledge, when I say I know things, it does not mean that I could not be mistaken. I can be mistaken about my knowledge. But the burden of proof is on the skeptic to tell me why I am mistaken. So when it comes to common sense, self-evident truths, I don't have to justify those. He needs to critique my views first. The burden of proof is on him when it comes to those things. And so we ought not to feel that we need to justify ourselves to the skeptic or the postmodernist. They need to critique our foundation first. So we need to let them do that in the conversation before we go defending our foundation. That's very important. So full 100% certainty is not necessary for knowledge, and we don't need to buy into the skeptic's line of reasoning that we have to be 100% certain before we know things. So when we say we know that Jesus rose from the grave, we know that God exists, we know that there was a flood, and Noah, and Jonah, and the whale, and all these things, we're not saying we are 100% certain. We are just saying we know them, and we are justified in our belief. William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland put it this way: foundationalism just seems to be the way that people actually and appropriately go about justifying their beliefs. So it's just the way that we go about living and thinking. And we don't need 100% certainty. So foundationalism then has nothing to do with certainty. So keep that in mind when you say that you're a foundationalist or a realist. You are not saying that you are 100% certain and you have infallible knowledge. Fundamentalist is more of a theological term. Foundationalism is more of a philosophical term. Fundamentalists would say that the Bible is completely inerrant and infallible, and those who are not Christians are completely irrational creatures until the knowledge of God is imparted to them when they become a Christian. So it's kind of a harsh view if you're a non-Christian to hear, but so fundamentalism, it comes off a bit strong. So, an evangelicalism, of course, comes out of fundamentalism, theologically speaking. But foundationalism is a philosophical thing that we're talking about here. Well, Christian liberalism comes from the higher criticism movements of Germany and Europe when they're talking about interpretation and hermeneutics. And so the higher criticism movement led to American liberalism, which was around before fundamentalism, and fundamentalism came as a reaction to European liberalism coming out of German, the 19th century German theology. But that's a fascinating little branch of history theologically between 1850 and 1920 something. I mean, because you have Darwin and all of that coming out, you have higher criticism in Germany. I mean, wow, and Princeton Theological Seminary was just... if you ever want to do some good theological research, look at Princeton around the early 1900s and all the thinkers that were there. Very amazing place to be. What is it? What are the Trotskyites? I'm not sure. I see. Yeah, perhaps. Well, the Russian, if you want to think about Russians who are influential too, I forgot to mention Dostoevsky. His book, all of his books were very influential for the existential movement too. So if you are getting into existentialism, check out Dostoevsky. Okay, so the third point we could say on this criticism is foundationalism need not be rejected when rejecting modernism. So rejecting foundationalism, as the postmoderns do, actually means accepting all of skepticism. So when you start rejecting foundationalism, then you are a complete skeptic. So again, skepticism is there is no way to justify the foundation of our belief system, in that you cannot be justified at all in any knowledge that you have. So that's skepticism. Whereas foundationalism says there is a foundation which requires no justification. And so foundationalism, again, also provides us with JTB, justified true belief. Do you guys remember that? Justified true belief, knowledge. So if someone asks you what's knowledge, what are you going to say? Christ. Give him my number. He talks about this stuff. He's really weird. So justified. We're going to talk about this in a moment anyway, so might as well talk about it now. True. Justified true belief. So what the skeptic says is you cannot have this, and therefore you cannot have that. You cannot have justification for your foundation, for your knowledge structure. Do you remember? Because Descartes, he wanted to build that skyscraper of knowledge, right? And the skeptic says, you can't ground this foundation on anything. There is no grounding there. And the foundationalist says, yes, there is. There is grounding there. The skeptic says, no, there's not. Yes, there is. So the foundationalist says that knowledge is justified true belief, and I don't need 100% certainty to be justified. And the skeptic says, no, there is no knowledge at all. No one has knowledge. And believe it or not, the postmodernist says exactly the same thing. You cannot have justified true belief. Awareness is just awareness. But you don't get any knowledge from awareness, according to the postmodernist. Bring that out a little bit more. Wait, one second. Let me finish this, because this is... I think you're trying to critique it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, consciousness. So if someone is not consciousness, they can't think about things, and if they can't think about things, they can't have knowledge. Yeah. So even the person who's talking to you, saying that there's no knowledge, he's refuting himself, because in order to be saying that, he has to be conscious, and consciousness allows knowledge.
What is the name for unjustified true
belief? Okay, so unjustified true belief is just considered a belief that you hold, but you have no warrant for it. You could be true in your belief, but you aren't justified by your method of reasoning. Okay? So a child could have belief that God exists, but he may not know why that belief is reasonable. And when he tries to articulate it, he says a bunch of random wacky stuff. You know, but in that sense, so he has an unjustified true belief. But he still has knowledge, because knowledge isn't only this, because Alvin Plantinga, philosopher out of Notre Dame, he says that we can have unwarranted true belief, and that still counts as knowledge. So that's debatable, but I'm not going to argue with Plantinga. But anyway, this is a good definition for it. And I would suggest sticking to this to avoid confusion. Now, we're going to talk about this more in a moment, so just hold this in your head as we go here. So the idea with this is foundationalism need not be rejected when rejecting modernism. So if the postmodernist continues to bash modernist notions, let them do so. That's okay. They suffer from the first two criticisms, as we previously saw. But also, you can still have foundationalism, which is a classical notion outside of modernism. Just to let you know, foundationalism is not a European, Western thinking sort of notion. Okay, it's very much what is called in in philosophy, a classical understanding. So as Christians, we also want to avoid using the term modernism, or we have a modernist understanding of the world, so postmodernism is flawed or something like that. We don't necessarily want to subscribe to modernism, because modernism isn't such a great thing either. This quest for certainty and a totalizing structure for our knowledge system, it's not a good idea to go after that sort of thing. It leads to humanism and all these other things. But when we talk to people, we want to say we have, in the philosophical sense, a classical understanding of reality, a classical worldview. Okay? So when this is a very much a classical sort of thing. When we're talking about justified true belief, foundationalism, we're talking about classical understandings, understanding of reality. Just to give you a sense, because I would hate for you to get caught up in a conversation and someone really critiquing modernism too much, even though they're doing themselves a disservice, you kind of be off the wrong foot because of that. So stick to classical. Stick to classical in your conversation. And that includes the understanding of the New Testament, because much of the New Testament thinkers were very much influenced by the Greeks and the Greek philosophers, John, Paul, all these guys. So hang out with that idea and consider that. That was just the cultural setting they found themselves in. That's all I'm saying. Now, now this is the fourth criticism. There are transcultural, universal standards that cannot be denied. So we've been talking about subjective morality. We've been talking about objective morality. We're going to continue that conversation. So there are transcultural, objective moral standards. These are, this is what I mean by that. Moral laws are discovered and exist regardless of whether or not anyone believes in them. They are furniture of the universe that we bump into. So if you think about it, if it's helpful, objective moral law is a nice big chair. We just bump into this thing, you know? We sit on it and we hit it, you know? But it's just this is an objective moral standard. It's a chair. You know, it's a furniture of the universe. And you just can't not bump into it. It's just there. It exists. If you go out into space somewhere, you're going to find this chair. It's there. And a subjective moral standard is something in here. It's something you make up and I make up, and it's part of the subject, right? So the object, the thing in itself, is part of the universe. So the postmodernist says that there are no such objective moral standards that we just run into. There are only subjective moral standards, things that we make up. So objective truths are self-evident. So intuitively, we know objective truths. And the burden of proof, again, is on the relativist or the postmodernist when it comes to these innate intuitive truths that we know. They need to prove to us that objective moral truths don't exist, because it seems to us that they are self-evident. Okay, so these are transcultural notions that apply to all cultures at all times on all planets, let's say, because these things are furniture of the universe. Every person, every culture bumps into these things. Now, they may disobey them, they may not care about them, whatever, but it doesn't mean they don't exist. In fact, even if we all denied it, they still exist. Here's an example William Lane Craig uses. He says, if the Nazis convinced everyone on the planet that killing Jews was a good idea and morally permissible and morally okay, and it's actually a good thing, it enhances the human race, it gives us a brighter future, we can be the best Aryan race we can be, and they convinced the entire planet, would killing Jews still be wrong? Yes. So killing people for the fun of it, is wrong, or killing people for other reasons outside of justice is wrong. So this is an objective moral truth. Torturing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong, no matter if we all think it's right. The action?
Yeah.
Well, if there's no God, no one. But if there's God, then God. Right. Yeah, that's fine. Because it doesn't really matter to them. Yeah, they don't care. If you think about it, there's no objective justice in the universe either. Justice is something that cultures define according to their laws. And their laws are just things that they write on pieces of paper and everyone seems to try to obey them. But they don't really connect with anything in the universe. So if I enslave 35-year-old girls in Cambodia as sex slaves, I'm not doing something that's unjust compared to a universal objective standard. I'm just doing something that is disobedient to the international law. I don't even know if Cambodia has a law, but, you know, laws that humans just created. So there's a question there. What is the correct moral law of the universe? What is the correct law that a society should have? Is there such a law out there that societies should incorporate? So this is now you're getting into legal philosophy. So anyway, the idea here is that according to the postmodern, yes. Knowledge is relative according to social structures and communities who create and devise schemes and laws and so forth. And the court system, they would say, is just this little dance we do. That's all, with people in robes. But there's no justice there. There's no objective universal justice. Sorry, I lost my place here. We'll take a break here shortly. Right here. We'll take a break right after this. So these laws, these laws are universally valid and applicable in all times, all places, all cultures. So we are saying that there are these objective moral chairs, furniture of the universe that people bump into, that are applicable in all times, all places, all cultures. Now, it's also true, not only for morality, but for the laws of logic. So when we're talking about the laws of logic, these are things that are also furniture of the universe that can't be denied. They're out there. So those that try to deny these laws of logic actually have to assume them first to deny them. And this would be self-refuting. So in order to deny a law of logic, you have to assume the law of logic in your denial, and that's self-refuting. So let's think about that in a moment by looking at these laws. So first, this quote, logic is built on four undeniable laws. I'm giving you three that are simple. There is no getting behind these laws to explain them. They are self-evident and self-explanatory. So the laws of logic are foundational in that sense. The laws of logic are the foundation of all of our thinking. Law of identity is just A is A. Law of non-contradiction, A is not non-A. Law of excluded middle, it's either A or non-A. So, if you want to think about it this way, the law of identity, killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong, is killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong. Okay, so A being a proposition or an idea. The law of non-contradiction, killing babies for the fun of it is not morally wrong, is not non-killing babies for the fun of it is not morally wrong, is morally wrong. So you get the idea. You take A and you fill in the blank with an idea, and then you start to go through these things, and then the law of non-excluded middle. It's either wrong to kill babies for the fun of it, or it's right. That's the idea. It's one or the other. It can't be both. So I am me and I'm not you. This is kind of the idea with the laws of logic. logic. They can't be denied. Interestingly, God is the best explanation for the foundation of these standards. So where do we get the furniture of the universe? Does it just magically appear out of nowhere? Or is there a source of these objective moral laws and the laws of logic? Yes, there is. The source of the objective moral laws and the laws of logic is God. So God is perfect rationality, he's perfect truth, and he's perfect in his ethical stances and principles, and what he says is good is good. So Christians have an excellent worldview in this sense, because we have a great explanation for where do objective moral laws and the laws of logic come from. Whereas the naturalist and the postmodernist don't have an explanation of where these things come from. So we can ask them, how do you explain this? How do you explain that in terms of justice, truth, meaning that is objective, that exists out in the universe regardless of anybody thinking about it or not, regardless if the whole world denies this, it's still there. How do you explain that? What's the foundation for it? The postmodernists and the naturalists don't have one. The Christians have one. And when you press them for it, they can't give you a good explanation. They try, but it's not a good one. Sociobiological morality?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is an explanation that they give. It's just a bad one. That our natural desires, our evolutionary instincts have given us a biological urge to produce a community, because that community will give us a defense against predators. So our ancient people groups would have gathered themselves together in these people groups and formed little cultures, because that gave them an added bonus of a big population that lions and cheetahs would not want to attack. And so it's good to be nice to each other. It's good to speak well about each other, not stab each other in the back, and you know, bring each other, you know, potluck, you know, when you get married, whatever. So you start developing these cultural norms because it seems that that is a good way to satisfy these biological urges of survival. And survival is best accomplished when you are in a group. There is a question in the back. Okay.
Apologetics seems to me only those so far as, you know,
Well, let me respond to that real quick, and then we'll go to break. There is a sense where you kind of have to throw up your hands when people are completely off the deep end, and no rational conversation is going to help them. However, that very much is an extreme fringe position. This postmodernism manifests itself in all shapes and sizes in our current culture. So we can't say the current culture is all reprobate and we shouldn't just evangelize or pray. Yeah, but see, the thing is that the people that write postmodern books and the original postmodern thinkers, a few names I gave you, they're not sociopaths. They're actually chairmen of academic departments at prestigious institutions in Paris. So we have to be careful here about how we take an idea and say this is not coherent and it leads to absurdities and stuff like that, and then bringing that and saying this is your idea, therefore you're absurd and you are completely incoherent and not reachable. So we want to be careful there to attack the worldview, and most of the time people don't even know these issues when they hold this worldview. That's the problem, is that we have to show them what their worldview is that they're talking through, and then we say this is why your worldview fails, because most of the time they won't even know. So anyway, let's take a break. And then we'll come back and do some more. All right? All right, cool. Okay, so we left off on that last point two of the fourth criticism under D. So now we're looking at point three under D. It says, in a postmodern culture, anyone's truth is tolerated, ... those worldviews that do not accept another's truth, and those worldviews that claim to have the absolute objective truth. So this sounds like an absolute double standard, and for them it's an absolute standard of intolerance that they apply across cultures. So what they're doing is they're saying that across all cultures, everybody should accept other people's views, accept those views that say that they have the truth. So you see what they're doing. They're using they are saying there is a transcultural standard out there that exists that says that everybody across all cultures should adopt and tolerate and accept everybody else's truth, except people that disagree with this transcultural objective standard. So this would imply that in the postmodern thinking, postmodernism would reject itself because it rejects those views that aren't inclusive, all-inclusive. So this, to us, sounds like an obvious self-contradiction, but postmodernism is still the dominant worldview of our culture today, even with these kinds of blatant contradictions. So the reason is because postmodernism makes superiority claims about language, literary texts, dichotomy of modernism and postmodernism, morality and values. So they claim to say that modernism sucks, postmodernism is great. Literary texts don't say this. The reader speaks, the reader understands what their literary text says. And they try to differentiate between and say, no, that thing is wrong, this thing is right. And in doing so, they are contradicting themselves because they then are claiming transcultural objective standards themselves. They just happen to be different transcultural objective standards that we know to be out there. So all of these claims are self-refuting because they claim that there is no objective vantage point and all claims on reality are equally valid. So it's self-refuting because they say themselves that there is no God's eye view of things. But they are claiming here, when they are claiming this messed up, confused view of tolerance, that they have the God's eye view of things, that they have the correct vantage point from the top of the mountain to see everything perfectly. And so that is why it's self-contradicting, because by claiming that there is no vantage point, they are claiming the vantage point. Any questions on point three there? Say it again.
The elephant.
Yeah. How do you know it's an elephant? The postmodernist likes to say that all religions are equally valid and correct because they are all describing the elephant in some way. And this is a classical analogy brought up by the philosopher John Hick, actually out of Claremont Graduate School here in SoCal in the 80s. And he brought up this elephant example, I believe. This you hear on the street all the time. Well, all the religions are just describing God the same. One's touching his ear, one religion is touching his nose, one religion is touching his leg, and they all are describing him, because it's a bunch of blind guys. You may have heard the parable. A bunch of blind guys are trying to touch the elephant, or trying to touch God and figure out what kind of a God he is. We all just describe him differently. But they are still describing the same elephant, the same God. Well, the flaw of that analogy is, who knows that it's the elephant? Who knows that it's an elephant? How do you know it's an elephant? How do you know it's just not a rock or something? So, yeah, that analogy fails because they claim to know it's an elephant. Okay, so the fourth point we could say is that arguments against postmodern moral relativism succeed. So when we're talking about transcultural objective moral standards and standards of justice that apply across everything, and the postmodernists say, no, there are no such thing, there is no foundation, there is no objective moral standard, nothing like that, no laws of logic, then they say this is how it is. It's all about relativism. What one culture says is good is good for that culture. What another culture says is good for that culture. And those two cultures don't need to compare themselves to each other. And we shouldn't be comparing one is better than the other. Well, this creates all sorts of problems. Not only is it self-refuting and so forth, but it brings up all these other issues. So if you look at cultural moral relativism there, the idea here, and we won't spend too much time into this because we'll talk about it in the next couple weeks, is that an anthropological notion that argues, this is cultural moral relativism, it's an anthropological notion that argues differences in moral behavior and norms in various cultures reveal that no objective moral transcultural standards exist. So what they're saying is that because cultures are different, there is no objective moral standard out there in the universe. There is no furniture of the universe that we just bump into because these cultures are different. They have different moral standards. They may be slightly different, and that slight difference reveals that there's no objective standard out there that these cultures are adopting. Well, the problem with this is it fails as it's a descriptive thesis about different morality found in cultures, and it is not evidence for the absence of transcultural moral standards across cultures. So what that means is that absence of evidence is not always evidence of absence. So if you think about it, just because there's a bunch of cultures out there and they all report slightly different things when we look at them and we analyze their moral systems, it doesn't mean that there are no transcultural objective moral standards still out there. Just because cultures are different in their manifestations of morality, it doesn't mean there are no objective moral standards. So what they're trying to argue is that when you look at all these cultures and you describe them and you create a descriptive thesis about them, you don't find these things. You don't find these objective moral standards in all these cultures. So therefore, there are none. So the non-postmodernist says the absence of evidence does not mean there is evidence of absence. So the absence of evidence of objective moral truths and standards does not mean there's the evidence of the absence of objective moral standards and truths. Now, interestingly, we actually do have evidence of objective moral standards across cultures. And I brought this up before, but we'll talk about it again here. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Abolition of Man, at the back, in the appendix, he chronologues all these objective moral standards that ancient cultures actually had in their writings, whether it was their laws or other poetry and different things like that, from the Babylonians to the Greeks to the Hebrews to the Hindus to the Aztecs and different things like that. He was able to find all of these objective moral standards that manifested themselves in the writings of even these ancient, more primitive cultures. So it's actually not the case, it's not true what postmodernist anthropologists say about cultural standards, that there are no similar cultural standards of morality. No, actually there are similar cultures, similar standards of morality across all these cultures, even way back then. And C.S. Lewis does a good job of revealing that. So their premise that there are no similarities is just wrong. He goes and talks about murder and things like that being morally wrong, and he shows the statement, he puts it right there, what the statement was in their writings. So as a whole, on this point D, we could say that because there are transcultural objective moral standards out there in the universe, the laws of logic are irrefutable and undeniable across cultures, and in order to deny them, you have to assume them, so you're self-refuting. Because postmodernism's self-refuting intolerance is ridiculous, and the failure of moral relativism, we can conclude that the transcultural universal moral standards cannot be denied, which is a point against postmodernism. So these four points lead to supporting D, the criticism of postmodernism. Point E, another criticism. There are problems with postmodernism as a view that holds that I cannot get outside of my social construction language lens. So you guys, do you remember last week we had this little guy up here, he had a little pair of glasses on, and we were talking about the language lens that postmodernism says that we all put on? Excuse me. Postmodernism say that we're stuck inside of our language. Postmodernism teaches culture presses the individual to have this ingrained brainwashed perspective, if you will, that we are all kind of brainwashed in our culture setting, and whatever culture thinks is good and bad and clean and unclean and so forth, we just adopt because we grew up in that culture. We've been brainwashed. We have these pair of glasses on. And we see the world through this lens. And so all the media that we've been exposed to, the people, the ideas, this is how our lens formed. Our parents and watching Big Bird on TV, all these sorts of things have led to us understanding the world as we do. And the culture's use of language is what ingrains truth to us. Remember, it's all about language. The words we say and how we say things is what creates truth for us. So we cannot escape our lens. We can't take our glasses off. Do you remember that? And the individual can only experience just a filtered image of reality. We can only experience the world as it comes through the lens. Maybe it's blue colored and rainbow colored, whatever. But this is how we experience reality. It's through this grid, our interpretive lens. And so language and experience affects our worldviews. And our worldviews, according to postmodernism, affects our language and experience. So not only is it a descriptive thesis, but it's a prescriptive one too. So as we see the world through this lens, we also create the world through this lens. We speak out again language that reaffirms and confirms the language of the culture of the time. So it's a language that describes, it's a lens that describes reality to us, and it's a lens that prescribes reality out to others. So they say that we make our worlds by how we talk. So we create truth by how we talk. If you remember, existentialism talked about how we create meaning in the world that's meaningless. Postmodernism says that we create truth in a world that's truthless. And so these are subjective truths. So truth then is relative to our culture, who's informing us and brainwashing us about truth. So truth becomes something that is different in one culture to another. It's all about the web of coherence of one culture versus the web of coherence of another. And if you just happen to grow up in that web, then it's going to make sense to you in so many ways. So the first thing we could say about this is that it's really inconsequential if I have a lens and cannot take it off. So let's give them their what they want. Okay, fine. You're right. We all have these lenses. We can't take it off, so forth. Well, it's actually irrelevant to me saying that I have knowledge and truth. Let's say I can't take my lens off, okay? I can still be actually right about what I believe. So if someone says, well, Jeremy, you just grew up in a conservative evangelical home, and that's why you believe Jesus rose from the grave, and that's why you believe God exists, and you accept everything in the Bible, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's fine. But it turns out I can still be right, and you can still be wrong, because you may have grown up in a communist, atheist sort of environment, something, and you think God doesn't exist and Jesus is a fairy tale. You can still be wrong, even though you have your lens. So the question is, how do you know if you have a lens, if you're right or wrong? Well, you have to get justified true belief to say that you're right or wrong about something, to say that you have the correct knowledge of the way the world actually is. So that is what we need to accomplish here. Yeah. The way we know how we're right and wrong is if we have justified true belief and they don't. So we do, and they don't. Now, it turns out that if the postmodernist says no, because of your lens, you can never know that you're right. You can never know that God exists and Jesus rose from the grave. You can't know those things because you grew up in that kind of Western Christian culture. They are actually committing what's called a genetic fallacy. The genetic fallacy says... It discredits the arguer's argument based on how his or her beliefs originated. So the origination of the belief, they say, is what can discredit the belief. But it's actually not true. So suppose my culture just informed me all the time that God exists and Jesus rose from the grave, and it reinforced that over and over and over again, and that's my lens. Okay, fine, let's say I can't take it off. Then they are saying that because of how I came to that belief is wrong. And when they say that, they are committing the genetic fallacy, which attacks the origin of my belief as a reason why my belief is wrong, not attacking the belief itself. Yeah, well, it is an ad hominem too. Exactly. It's both. Yeah, it's an ad hominem and a genetic fallacy. So the response to that is that we must stick to the merits of the argument, the reasons I am offering for why God exists and why Jesus rose from the grave. We must stick to the evidence and the reasons and the logic here, Mr. Non-Christian. And you need to treat what I'm offering as a rational set of arguments for my position, not the origination method of my belief. Because once you start doing that, you are committing a logical fallacy. And whoever commits logical fallacies is now irrational or is thinking irrationally. So we need to point that out to them, because this is a common criticism of Christianity, that you grew up you're a Christian because you grew up a Christian. If you grew up in India, you would have grown up Hindu. But that doesn't treat the argument itself or the evidence and the reasons for the belief in God and for the belief in the resurrection. So we need to steer the conversation back at that point to the merits of our argument of why our belief system is right and why theirs is lacking the same level of justification. Yeah, you're right. They don't. But then you have to. What they're actually saying is nobody is right, or we're all right. That's what they're saying. So then you have to say is actually no, that's not true. We're not all right, and we're not all wrong. And when Andy comes in a couple weeks or next week, we're going to talk about that, how these religions can't all be right or all wrong. So, yes, sir.
I've always had a problem with the physics that individuals have for irrational thought. I always have a
goes back to what Taylor was saying earlier. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed, but we're starting to see this attack on human persons and human nature. And what were you alluding? Yeah, what you're alluding to has to do with this idea that we need to change what we are as humans, because our nature isn't what God said it is. It is what we decide it is. Yeah. That gets to my outline. Did you guys read my humanism outline? It was really good. It talks about that. Good point, yeah. I'll give you my humanism outline. Yes. Yeah. Divergent. Divergent, the movie. Maybe you want to check it out. Yes, sir. Well, yeah. So, look, what is human nature then? We have to get into what's the human nature, what's animal nature. Aristotle did a whole thing on animal nature and different things like that. But we believe that humans are made in the image of God. You know, first chapter of Genesis again. I mean, we're talking about some profound philosophy right there. Humans made in the image of God. What does that mean? Physical likeness, or spiritual, or soulish likeness? So Christians believe that we have the same type of rationality he has, and that is different than the animals. So the animals can't think at the level we do. So anyway, yeah, it's a really good question. It's a really intriguing to think about the soul of an animal and what that is, how that's different. But it is intriguing to this issue. I'd like to try to finish up with the 2 minutes we have left here, and then we'll have to... We have like 10 pages to go in 2 minutes, right? Okay, so help me out here, read fast. No, I'm kidding. We'll see if we get through a few more points on this one. So now let's say, okay, well, I can actually remove my lens. I can take them off. So many people in the history of the world have actually been non-conformist to their culture. They've actually pushed against culture and gone against the grain and swam upstream, so to speak. So this is especially evident when worldviews shift in a culture. When a culture becomes more, say, open to African Americans, having the same rights as whites. In fact, the shift from modernism to postmodernism shows that postmodern thinkers became reprogrammed to get outside of their own modernist language-oriented lenses and see the world through their postmodern lenses. So what we're saying here is that in order for these postmodern thinkers, the three that I gave you, to become postmodern thinkers in a modernist framework, they were able themselves to go against the grain and think outside of the box and take their lenses off and then create a postmodern framework for everybody else. So they themselves got out of their lens that they say that no one can get out of. They themselves were able to take off their glasses that they say no one can take off. So since they removed their alleged lenses, their worldview is contradicted right there. Another point we could say is that we cannot socially construct and create real truth. So they say that we can construct truth, we can create truth just out of us speaking it, just like the existentialist said we could create meaning. So they say that one's culture's social constructions and attempts to at creating, well, we say this, one's culture's social constructions and attempts at creating objective reality do not actually create or even alter objective universal truths. Reality simply is what it is. So what I'm saying here is that just because you say that homosexuals should have the right to marry whoever they want, including children, and I say, no, they shouldn't. Well, it doesn't change the fact that there's a chair out there in the universe that says something on this issue. So just because we say something to each other, it doesn't mean that there is not an objective moral standard. So suppose my culture has a view of reality that can come and go depending on who's thinking about it and what people are thinking. And if we collectively think together, we come to this conclusion as a group. Suppose we fast for a week, let's say, and then we get around a fire and we start beating the drums in the middle of the night and we start dancing around this fire, and we, as a subculture and as a group, together we decide we are going to create reality that night. And so we bring all of our instruments, we bring all of our drugs, and because we're fasting, the drugs will have an awesome impact on us. And we do our dance all through the night, 3 a.m, as we do our drugs together, and as we dance around the fire and beat our drums louder and louder, we create a wonderful time. We have some amazing realities appear and disappear to us. And we have these outer body experiences. We start seeing all sorts of paranormal activity, aliens, ghosts. We start hallucinating in all sorts of different ways. And we have these wild delusions. And we actually become unconscious at the end of the night. And we created our own reality. We created our own truth as a social people group. What is the problem with this? Even though, yes, we socially constructed reality, the problem is we wake up the next morning, either on one side of the grave or the other, and if we wake up on this side, we are still lying on the floor at a campground around a burnt out fire, and we feel crappy. Reality is what it is. It doesn't change. No matter how many people groups come and go and create, according to the postmodern, their own social world and their own social realities, there is still one objective reality out there. There's still one truth that we all bump into. And so reality simply is what it is. So the final thing we could say on this is that language depends on reality. Reality doesn't depend on language. Language depends on reality. Reality doesn't depend on language. Reality does not depend on you and me doing anything we want together. And that includes doing fire dances, yeah. So there's all sorts of things we could say about this, but that's kind of the main thought. I've given you many more criticisms here of postmodernism. We obviously don't have time to get into them tonight unless you guys wanted to continue this next week and I push back a bunch of other things. So what I would like to do is send you an email and ask for your thoughts on whether or not you want to finish this sort of outline. And you could, or do you want to go into the relativism pluralism conversations? Either way, it's fine because I've already given it to you here. It's just a matter of whether or not we do it together in class or whether or not you read it on your own time. It's up to you. So if you can just respond to my email, that'd be good because there's a lot of good stuff here for you. So having said that, I'd like to close in prayer, and I'd love to chat with you after more on some of these things that we didn't have time for here. All right, shall we close? Dear God, we thank you so much for being the source of truth, for being the source of all reality, including ourselves and our own minds. And Lord, we thank you that we had time tonight to exercise our thinking and to just try our best to come to terms with this view of postmodernism and understand it and refute it and see why this view has some significant problems. And already, just with this little bit, we've seen that postmodernism really does not give us much and it ultimately does not compare to Christianity. And Lord, we just thank you so much that you've given us the opportunity to be a part of your world and understand your world, and hopefully, Lord, you allow us to understand it more as you see it and as it really is. So we pray that you would guide us, since you are the source of all truth, to you more, and we would see truth more clearly. In Jesus' name, amen.